This podcast is kindly supported by Vodafone.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth and the Mail on Sunday columnist Dan Hodges. Now, it's beginning to look inevitable that Boris Johnson is going to be crowned the next Prime Minister in 2 weeks' time. But what of how he will govern? As ministers jostle and non-ministers to be in his cabinet, there are other factions keep competing for his approval. It's been predicted that Boris Johnson will have more of a court than his predecessors, with groups of courtiers offering rival advice. He will listen to these groups and play them off. So which groups are vying for Johnson's ear? Now, I've written this week on Coffee House about this and I count eight, but I'm sure my guests today will be able to add some of their own. But just to run through them, we have the old retainers, and these are the old-time parliamentary supporters of Boris Johnson. Figures like Ben Wallace and Nigel Adams, Jake Berry. These are supporters who've been with him since 2016, and when he didn't have such luck with his Tory leadership campaign and have stuck through him through thick and thin. We have the new kids on the block. That's people like Gavin Williamson, James Wharton, who've come for the 2019 effort. There's also the City Hall crew, people who were around Boris Johnson when he was Mayor of London, and we expect to have a prominent role if he takes number 10, Will Walden, Sir Eddie Lister. Then there's the European Research Group, spoken a lot, many times on Coffee House Shots, figures like Jacob Rees-Mogg, Marc Francois, Brexiteers who want to see their Brexit delivered. There's Team Vote Leave, those Boris Johnson knows from the EU referendum campaign. There are the eco-warriors, as we could call them, Carrie Simmons, Zach Goldsmith, Ben Elliott. And then there are the men and women of government, those figures trying to ensure they have a place in the Boris Johnson cabinet. And finally, there's Team Crosby-Texter, Lyndon Crosby, and what role he is or isn't playing. So, Dan, to start with you, I've listed what I think are some of the groups. How do you see the various groups forming around Boris Johnson?
I think you very accurately describe the groups that are forming around Boris. But I think it's quite interesting to step back and ask why it is that we do have so many disparate groups sort of jostling for the king's ear at the moment. And I think the fundamental problem that Boris Johnson is going to face is there are no Johnsonites as such. Boris, when he takes over, is going to be, in my view, one of the most personally isolated, or maybe politically isolated, prime ministers we've had. When Blair took over, he was obviously at the heart of a very extensive, very well-disciplined, very sophisticated ideological stroke political movement. To the same extent, when David Cameron took over, the Cameronites had spent a number of years planning their political strategy, buying into the political strategy, organising around their political strategy. Boris is not going to have any of that. And actually, the person I think who he reminds me of, in a sense, is Theresa May. And when Theresa May took over and was herself quite isolated quite early on within cabinet and more broadly politically. And I think that's why we've got this, we're already seeing it within the campaign. There is already a degree of sort of factional infighting, which is less actually factional and more personal for Boris's ear. And I think as we move forward, that is going to potentially be a serious problem.
James, do you agree that it could be a rather chaotic court?
I think it's worth remembering, which is whatever the political wisdom of this, this is kind of what Boris Johnson wants. He doesn't like being tied down to one source of political advice. He likes this orb, you know, he likes to sit there as a kind of sun king with these people kind of orbiting around him. And he doesn't like to decisively choose to back one group or the other. Now, you can argue that that's going to be a recipe for trouble in Downing Street, etc., etc., etc. But I think we see that he has deliberately chosen to have this kind of almost open door policy towards people. You know, he's chosen to stay in touch with multiple people. I think back to when Miliband won the Labour leadership and his aides took his mobile phone off him on the basis that, you know, all communication was going to have to come through someone. No one's taking Boris Johnson's mobile phone off him. And indeed, I think he still is in communication with a whole bunch of people by text. That is where I think the role of Eddie Lister comes in, which is, you know, the idea of someone who Boris trusts, you know, his old City Hall chief of staff, somebody who can kind of try and kind of manage this process. But I need to touch on Dan's point. It's worth remembering that the Tory party has kind of picked Boris Johnson for an essentially instrumental reason, which is they think that in the current political predicament they are in, he is the person who can get them out of this mess. And that is essentially the mission he's had. And you know, if he fails in that, he is going to be even lonelier than most people in politics are. But if he succeeds, it will create its own momentum.
Now, when we look at the various groups, there are some, I think, who would say that they actually have the greatest influence when it comes to speaking to Boris Johnson, to getting what they want. But it isn't always that way. Dan, which figures do you think have the most, or wield the most influence on Boris Johnson? You've written previously in your Mail and Sunday column about the fact there seems to at times be this official campaign behind Boris Johnson, so the people who have actual press roles. And then there also seems to be Team Carrie at times, and that's Carrie Simmons, his partner, who I list in the Eco Warrior group, so in part because she has a focus on environmentalism.
Yes, I think that was, how shall I put it, that's quite a generous demarcation for Carrie's role within Team Boris. I think, certainly speaking to team within people within the official campaign, they see her influence as going quite much
beyond,
wider
beyond
than
things.
Beyond merely the sinecure of green issues, I have to be honest. No, I mean, I think she is obviously going to be an influential figure within his administration, or certainly as his campaign currently seems to be structured, she's going to be influential. I mean, being entirely honest, there is no doubt there are a number of very senior people around Boris Johnson who are very concerned about Carrie Simon's potential influence upon his administration, and that is something that a number of people are now giving active thought to about how that is managed going forward. But I think more broadly, to sort of broaden it out from Carrie, I mean, I think James has touched on it, I think the reality is that each of the people that you listed will at various times have a significant degree of influence over Boris, depending on the issue of the moment. I think also depending on the political reality of the moment. I think there is no doubt that the biggest decision that he's going to have to make is how he integrates the ERG and that sort of very hardcore strand of Tory pro-Brexit Euroscepticism into his administration. Because, as James said, that Boris Johnson has one job at the moment, and that job is to bring back to the Tory fold those Tory voters who have abandoned the Tory party for the Brexit party. I mean, the reality is, it is not Boris Johnson that has won Boris Johnson this leadership election. It is Nigel Farage who has won Boris Johnson this leadership election. And the moment Boris Johnson's accession was secured was the European elections, where the Tories were annihilated by Farage and the Brexit party. So I think in the short term, that is going to be the biggest fundamental issue. How does he integrate that, as I say, that hardcore ERG element into his cabinet and into his government without completely alienating the more moderate elements of the cabinet?
And let's talk about that, James, because when we look at these various groups, there are some that have, I suppose, a more likelihood to run into or against each other. And you have the European Research Group, you have figures like Jacob Rees-Mogg, Ian Duncan-Smith, who has now been given an official role in the membership stage of the contest. But you also have the group I put down as the men and women of government, and by that I mean people like Matt Hancock, Rishi Sunak, Robert Jenrick, Lucy Fraser, people who you wouldn't really expect to have too much in common with the people who go to an ERG meeting, yet they're currently now behind the same candidate. So do you think you can see a route where Boris Johnson can keep Steve Baker happy and also keep the men and women of government happy? Will they be happy just to have a job, even if they go for this very hard Brexit?
So I think the Panglossian view is Boris Johnson puts no deal on the table. The Europeans decide that he is, despite having said it's a million to one chance, he really is serious about this. He really is prepared to walk away. A concession is offered up on the backstop that is sufficient to satisfy the DUP. The EU reopen the withdrawal agreement to put it in. Boris Johnson declares it a great diplomatic triumph, brings it back to Parliament. And because it is Boris Johnson selling it, and because of what he is saying about stage two of the process, you know, you don't get all of the ERG, but you whistle down and most of them vote for it. And some more Labour MPs vote for it because they are more genuinely worried about no deal this time. And he gets a deal through and suddenly he's off to the races. The air starts to come out of the Brexit party balloon. He's going for it. The alternative view is that there are two pessimistic views. One pessimistic view would be that the EU calls his bluff and he is left at that point having to decide whether to do no deal or not, and at which point Parliament steps in and essentially everything comes tumbling down. I think there is a big question about the ERG and the splits in it that occurred on the third time that May's deal was brought to the Commons, when figures like Ian Duncan-Smith, Jacob Rees-Mogg, and Boris Johnson himself voted for the deal to get Brexit, while as Steve Baker and Mark Francois continue to inveigh against it. I think there is an interesting question about where the ERG are and how much they really, you know, because ultimately the only bit of the withdrawal agreement that has a kind of last forever is the backstop. And if that backstop stopped lasting forever, would they consider $39 billion to get out of the EU cheaper the price? And would a lot of their other concerns fade away because of the direction Boris Johnson was promising to go in phase two of the negotiations? I think there is a very interesting question about what is the test to serve in his cabinet. Is it a willingness to publicly say the UK is leaving on October the 31st, come what may? We would like to leave with a deal, but we will leave on October the 31st, come what may, with no deal if necessary. Is that the test? And you see people such as Amber Rudd beginning to move themselves towards that point of view. Or is the test genuinely believing that no deal would be fine? And I mean, that is a tension. I mean, there are some people close to Boris Johnson who are saying to him, no, you should only pick people who are in the latter camp. And other people saying, no, your government won't be broad enough based if you do that. It's better to say, look, if you're prepared to publicly and privately support a policy, that is enough.
And looking to the cabinet, when you look at the various factions, there are some who clearly aren't MPs, they're not in the parliamentary arena. But if you look at perhaps the old retainers, so that group of MPs who have been with Boris Johnson for the long haul now, back when it was unfashionable to do so. So figures like Ben Wallace, Nigel Adams, Jake Berry, Conor Burns to a degree. Dan, are these figures going to expect to get cabinet jobs in return? Because you also see people since then, maybe in Gavin Williamson, and then again we have all the cabinet ministers. So is there going to be a scramble to test his loyalties?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the problem. I mean, this goes back to what I was talking about earlier when I was saying about, if you like, the lack of Johnsonites, and as it were, a Johnsonite organisation. I mean, with the greatest respect of those people that you have just listed as the old retainers, they are not people you would instinctively say are sitting at the top rank of talent within the parliamentary Conservative Party. And there is going to be a decision Boris is going to have to make about the extent to which he rewards his allies, but also has to reward and rely on those people who have not instinctively been his allies. And I think, to follow up with what I think, because I think James made a very, very important point, which again goes back to this balance between the ERG and those sort of government, I think you called them, what was it, government sort of...
Men and women of government
who are in a very different place from the ERG. I mean, the reality is that Boris, for all his boundless optimism, is not going to be able to secure a markedly different offer from the European Union to that was offered to Theresa May. And at that point, there are two questions. One, to what extent will the ERG be prepared to sell minor concessions to Boris as major concessions or concessions significant enough to give Boris's withdrawal agreement a fair wind? And the second thing is, if they can't sell that and Boris is presented with the option, no other option but no deal, to what extent the men and women of government who are prepared to, as it were, go along for the ride up until October the 31st, at that point feel they have to get off the ride? Because whilst you can see circumstances where, say, an Amber Rudd, for example, can agree to serve in government to try and, as it were, lend her weight to efforts to secure a deal and move us away from a no-deal scenario, to get to a point where Amber Rudd is actually standing up advocating a no-deal scenario before or on October 31st, that is a real stretch.
Yeah, I think weird enough, if the EU slam the door in Boris Johnson's face and say, we're not talking to you, that actually makes his life easier. Because I think the vast majority of those men and women of government types, I used to use the phrase men of government, Katie has updated it. I think most of them, and I think maybe even Amber Rudd would be able to say, look, okay, if the EU won't negotiate, then the blame lies there. But if they are prepared to negotiate and the concessions that are offered, if they are genuine concessions, are not enough, when that will matter. One person I think we haven't talked about, who we maybe should, because I think he'll be hugely important, is David Frost, former Europe Strategy Director at the Foreign Office, former British Ambassador to Belgium, then went to run the Scottish Whisky Association. Boris Johnson then recruited him to be his special advisor at the Foreign Office. Boris Johnson has huge respect for his opinion. I am almost certain that he will come into number 10 and that he will play a big role in shaping Boris's Brexit policy. And I think the biggest single question of Boris Johnson's premiership is what does he choose to kind of essentially ask for on Brexit? And I think it is quite revealing that a lot of the work in the transition team on Brexit is being done by Geoffrey Cox, the current Attorney General, because that, to my mind, suggests that the instinct is more towards let's get a change so that the backstop isn't permanent, rather than a right, let's start writing this whole treaty, withdrawal agreement treaty, from scratch.
Now, finally, and James, I think you might have just answered the question, but I wanted to ask you both, which figure or figures do you think, to listeners, would you say are perhaps the most important people from your perspective when it comes to the call to Boris Johnson?
I think I'm not trying to duck the issue, but I will duck the issue.
Rising star, a rising courtier.
No, I think as we've said, the nature of the Boris Johnson court is it is going to be so broad, it is going to be so diffuse, it is going to be so non-ideological in that sense, that I think we are going to see a number of people rising and falling as the political circumstances and the political situation demands. And I think at this stage, to pick out one individual, I have to say I'd be making it up. And I think one of the things that is concerning a number of Conservative MPs is that there is a perception of a lack of order and a lack of structure, which whilst may align itself with the more engaging and flamboyant aspects of our next Prime Minister's character, is something that is causing the concern about how it will actually work when it comes to the day-to-day administration of the government.
I think you should go with the wisdom of crowds on this. Someone who was at the Policy Exchange Summer Party the other day said they looked out and they saw this massive donut of people crowding around, you know, everyone, ministers, journalists, spads, and they wondered who this was, and they thought this must be the most powerful man in England. And so, being a politician, what they did was they basically worked their way round to get close to see who this person was, to talk to them, and it was Eddie Lister. And I think that reveals how important he's going to be. I think, you know, Boris Johnson is going to be very important. You know, in that, if you were talking about if you were an ambitious Tory, the two phone numbers you want right now is Boris Johnson and Eddie Lister's mobile numbers. Because if you can text Boris Johnson, he might, because of the way his mind works, it might slip his mind that you've texted him. But if you can also text Eddie Lister, you're probably kind of guaranteeing your follow-up there. And I think essentially what Eddie Lister will be is not only the chief of staff, but the kind of gatekeeper. I think it was, you know, I think Boris is telling a lot of people that they're going to be in the room when big decisions are taken. I think the cast list for these meetings, that kind of thing, is going to be in Eddie Lister's hands. And so I think it will be Eddie Lister who will determine kind of what the balance of the factions at these key meetings are. So if I had to name just, you know, one person, I think it probably would be Eddie Lister. I also think there's another thing to remember, which is I think first 100 days Boris will be very different from the rest of his premiership. As I understand it, the kind of essentially the deal with Eddie Lister is that he's coming in to get Boris through that first 100 days to October the 31st and a bit beyond. But don't expect him, if Boris Johnson is Prime Minister for, you know, 6-7 years, don't expect Eddie Lister to be there at the end of it. I mean, Eddie Lister is only going to do this to get him through this bit. And then I think the Boris Johnson government will evolve. And I think if this government, if the Boris Johnson government survives, which is obviously a big if, I think it will kind of, you know, constantly regenerate itself and come out in different types. I mean, we'll see at first, it's obviously going to be the Brexit Boris government at first. Then I think you'll see the kind of big domestic reform government. If he manages to get a Brexit deal through, I think it will constantly keep evolving.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Dan. And if you like this podcast, do leave us a review on the iTunes store. And while you're here, why not subscribe to the magazine if you haven't already? We have a current offer of 12 issues for £12, along with a £20 Amazon voucher. Just go to www.spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Vodafone made Britain's first mobile phone call on New Year's Day 1985, sent the first text message in 1992, and are now bringing 5G to 19 towns and cities across the UK this year. For more information, head to spectator.co.uk/VodafoneUK.